to lose power. Every candle collected, tub full of water, street siren, news anchor go silent. The basement space beneath the staircase is a playhouse and a stage. By the spotlight of the tallest burning wick, she writes a plot line with her poems and
good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 14th of October. A delight to have you with us as always. We thank you very much, and it means a lot to us that you tune in and want to hear what we all have to say. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, if you'd like to get in and talk about some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a wonderful panel. And I would like to introduce them. Before we do, I just have a quick thing that I want to talk about. When we do this show, and we've been doing the show for over 25 years now, there are people who have come in and come out and have been a part of our program. And I'm pleased to say that we have three wonderful individuals who've been a part of this show for a long, long time. And because that's the case, you get to know them very well. You get to really befriend them and enjoy the time you get to spend with them. And we had a gentleman by the name of Jesse Feiler. And Jesse was our tech guru. And Jesse was on this show from before the inception of the roundtable. He was on going back into Y2K, the run up to Y2K, and so forth, and was with us and was a frequent guest, and really was a neat guy, and lived in Philmont, moved to Plattsburgh. Born in D.C. and was a software developer, wrote a lot of the For Dummies books,
DOS for Dummies.
Yeah, right. getting your PC for Dummies, that kind of thing. And he was consequently, I would see not only very friendly with Jesse, but I would see him at book conventions and things in the city. And then we got into the habit of going out. He'd meet up in the city and we'd go see shows. And he would say, I'd really like to see the new Tracy Letts play. And we would go, and he was just the consummate professional. He would a playwright himself, I should mention. And he would watch the show, and he was so polite and such a great audience member. And then in the cab on the way back, he would just eviscerate it. It was just lovely. He had a biting, dry, bone dry wit. He was an animal lover. He had beautiful dogs that he rescued. So this is what I feel horrible about. He passed away some time ago. He passed away in February. I just learned about it yesterday. And I did not know about it. He lived alone. He lived in Plattsburgh. And there were friends who were there, and that's wonderful. I didn't know about it until yesterday because they're planning a celebration of life later this month in New York City. I just wanted to tell the audience, because he's been a part of the show for so long. He was actually on about 2 or 3 weeks before his passing.
Wow.
And, and it wasn't – like we would hear from – he was usually on every month, but sometimes – we wouldn't hear from him simply because he had a book that he was working on, and he would say, I just need a couple months off, and I just need, So we didn't really think that much about it, and so then I found that out yesterday. I just want to his extended family, my heartfelt condolences on behalf of all of us here at the Roundtable and all of us here at WAMC. He was a presence. We loved him. If you get a chance and you want to go online and just put in Jesse Feiler, Feiler, and listen to one of his segments, he's just funny and accessible and just a lovely, lovely, lovely man. Also, there are two charities that were very, very important. One was Friends of the Saranac River Trail that he worked so much on, and the other is HB Studio in New York, in which he worked on because he was friends with Uta Hagen, because that's the kind of guy Jesse was. And you can find out more by just going to Googling Jesse Feiler and seeing the obit. But wanted to send our condolences. He was only 77 years old. I'm one of those people who believes that 77 is just too damn young to die. And he was an absolute sweetheart, and I will miss him horribly. And I wanted you to know about that news, because I know he was special to a lot of people as well. All right, let's go to the folks that we have in our studio today, who we want to welcome properly. We begin with the Empire Report's J.P. Miller. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Joe, I'm good. Thank you for having me. And that was a beautiful, heartwarming tribute you gave to Jesse. That was really wonderful.
Well, thank
you. I feel I'm happy to be here this morning to hear it live.
Well, thank you. Yeah, he was a cool guy. And we welcome Mike Spain to the program. Mike is a former Times Union associate editor, and great to have Mike here always.
Well, thanks very much, and it's nice to be part of this today.
Yeah, thank you very much. We also welcome the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. What's going on, Mayor?
Living the dream.
Things going well? Everything going all right?
Everything's going well.
That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
It's always wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. We welcome your participation as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Donald Trump said yesterday while in the Middle East that it was a new Middle East, is what he said during his speech. He landed in Israel Monday morning, minutes after the first of 20 hostages were released by Hamas, and spent the day basking in the applause of a country that credits him more than Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for joyous family reunions and a ceasefire after 2 years of war. Mr. Trump seized on the moment to tell the Knesset, Israel's parliament, that this is, quote, not only the end of a war, this is the end of the age of terror and death, using a line that other presidents have reached for and often been disappointed. He added, this is the historic dawn of a new Middle East. He then traveled to Egypt, where dozens of world leaders awaited his arrival for a quote-unquote peace summit that offered the pomp and circumstance that Mr. Trump is known to enjoy. Banners adorned with his face were dotted along the streets of a Red Sea resort. From the cities, the will of the people of meets the resolve of the world leaders to end the war in Gaza, said the president of Egypt. They all carry a single message to mankind: enough war, welcome to peace. Now the question, at the summit, neither Israel nor Hamas were participants, and although the White House released what appeared to be a document signed by the countries that did attend, it did not commit the signatories to any specific action. Rarely has an American president, particularly one as divisive as at home as Mr. Trump, is been met with such adulation abroad. In Hostages Square in Tel Aviv, tens of thousands yelled Trump, 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 and the Knesset, some members wore red MAGA style hats. All of this comes at the point when, meanwhile, Mr. Netanyahu, whose name was booed at the same square, declared the president the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. And, of course, more talk of nominating for the Nobel Peace Prize and the Israel Prize. And all of this to say, we still don't know what's going to happen next. And there is a lot of the hostage release and the turnover was certainly something that that was being worked on for a long time, and you can't take that away from the president and for all those who work so hard on it. But where we go from here is still a huge question mark, and one that I think we'll see over time as to how it plays out. So As we look at those facts, who would like to start us off? Mayor, you want to?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I think everyone is breathing a huge sigh of relief that the fighting in Gaza has stopped, and are hopeful that the hundreds of truckloads of aid that are desperately needed reach the Palestinians in Gaza, and that the rebuilding is able to begin, and that this is truly an end to the violence there. The next phase and the next stage of this is what comes next. And, you know, look, I think that, you know, to the extent that Trump can claim credit for this, it is a good thing that the violence has ended. But we also have a president who has serially underrated the complexity of most situations that he has faced, whether it was the ease with which he thought he could repeal Obamacare in his first term, his response to COVID saying it would end by Easter, you know, the complexity of ending the war in Ukraine, the complexity of immigration policy and bringing sound immigration policy to the U.S. So, again, he has serially underrated the complexity of these situations. And I think that those of us who are skeptical about his proclamation could be forgiven, given that history.
JP.
Yeah, I was, you know, as you read and listen to Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer praise the president and his leadership, you kind of have to rub your eyes and make sure that you read it and heard it correctly. It's kind of unbelievable that, you know, there's bipartisan praise for the president on this huge victory for him and certainly for the people of Israel and also the people of Palestine. I was very happy for the 20 living hostages that got back to their families and the 1,700 Palestinian captured folks that were also returned. I agree a lot with what Mayor Sheehan said in that, you know, when Trump says it's a new Middle East, if you look at it from a global perspective, are the relations between Israel and the people of Palestine better or worse than they were 2 years ago on October 7th before the attack happened? It's obviously a much more dangerous place than it was 2 years ago. It's a much worse situation both for Israelis and for Palestinians. And you know what? You know, if someone thinks that there's not going to be another terrorist attack from Hamas or another, you know, overwrought response from Israel, I would argue that there will be. It's a question of when, not if. I think that if you look at what Hamas, I think, was trying to achieve on October 7th with their terrorist attack where they slaughtered, I think, over 1,000 innocent people, part of their big objective was to diminish support for Israel in the United States. And Hamas, in my view, achieved their objective in that you have seen United States public support, both from Democrats and Republicans, has significantly diminished since the war started. And from that standpoint, I think Hamas partially achieved one of their objectives.
Mike?
Yeah, often people have compared the way Trump approaches these things, you know, Ukraine, Obamacare, whatever. He is like the developer that comes in and goes for the big announcement that we have a big plan, it's great, and there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. In this case, I hope he's right, but usually you guys go work out the details, and that's kind of the way it sounds. It's, you know, it is wonderful that the killing has stopped, although the BBC reported just a little while ago there's been some violence along the line where the Israeli soldiers are and Palestinians are. But the reality is a lot has to be worked out. It was a 20-point peace plan to which Hamas and Israel had not agreed to all of them. And we don't know if Hamas is going to put down its arms. We don't know if Hamas will accept not being part of the civilian oversight and want to be a part of that? And who is going to emerge as the leadership, the government in Palestine right now? And it, certainly, while President Trump was declaring, and I hope he's correct, that this is a great day of peace and that it will change the whole Middle East, Bibi Netanyahu was standing right there. He hasn't acknowledged that this is over, and it's more like a ceasefire. He hasn't, by any means, and certainly is opposed to any kind of independence for Palestine. And the neither Hamas or Israel were in Egypt when these 20 or so countries were signing a peace agreement, which really is only a document saying we want peace. It doesn't have any details. So, yes, we can be forgiven for being skeptical, Mayor Sheehan. You're right. And hoping that the people to which Trump and others delegate to work out the details are skilled and successful. Ordinarily in diplomacy, a lot of that's worked out before the big announcement. This is in reverse. The big announcement happened, and good things are happened because of it, and we applaud that. But a lot of details, and gosh, it's a lot of hurdles to overcome.
And I think that, you know, you said that, you know, the killing has stopped, the violence has stopped, but, you know, that's still very tenuous. But I also think that for the Palestinians, the deaths have not stopped. The humanitarian crisis created by Netanyahu's war and the devastating impact that it has had, I think calls for a real sense of urgency from nations around the world to come to the aid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And I don't think that we have the slightest sliver of understanding of, well, I guess we do have an understanding of what that's going to take. We've seen devastation post-World War II. We've seen it, but this is on a massive scale that is going to require for the world to step up and for Israel to step up and bring aid as quickly as possible. Because there are people who are still dying because they don't have access to the medical care that they need. They don't have the nutritional needs met. So I think that response is what the world is going to be watching.
Yeah, and I agree. And I also think that we are in a new phase in that without Hamas holding innocent people as captives, a lot of the justification of what Netanyahu and the Israeli government, that justification now is gone. So,
well, we'll take a break, and when we come back, well, I'll let you finish your thought, and we'll continue our conversation on this issue. We, of course, welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation on this Tuesday morning after this news break from the BBC.
It's a meatloaf day. Does anyone have something new to say?
Hearing the music of Spencer LaJoy this morning, the album Shadow Puppets. Spencer playing Cafe Lena on the 16th of October, 2 days from today. Cafe Lena, don't forget, two Fs, C-A-F-F-E. CafeLena.org, and our playlist is online at WAMC.org, WAMC.org. So, I mean, we talked about this, but looking at this article in the New York Times, getting Israel's hostages released from Gaza and stopping the war may have taken 2 years in the direct efforts of the American president and the leaders of several Arab and Muslim nations. But that was almost certainly the easy part, getting Hamas to give up its weapons and demilitarizing the Gaza Strip. Key preconditions for Israel to pull out of Gaza fully, as both President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reiterated on Monday, could prove a lot harder. Then there are the other issues in Mr. Trump's 20-point plan. Mike was pointing to this earlier, which outlined a comprehensive solution for Gaza. In full, it also called for the establishment of an international force to help maintain security in the territory, an ambitious effort to rebuild Gaza's economy and infrastructure, and the creation of a temporary Palestinian governing committee whose work would be overseen by an international board. During the talks leading up to the ceasefire in Gaza, provisions for who would run the enclave on the day after the war was over were among the most complicated and vexing, so much so that they were eventually severed from the ceasefire talks and put off until a second phase of negotiations. And that's really what I wanted to talk for a moment about, of exactly how you think those, the second part of those negotiations are going to go, because this is where the real issues are going to have to be discussed.
Well, JP just mentioned that Israel no longer has an issue that could they used to justify their attacks on Gaza. I don't know that they were justified, but that was at least a legitimate issue of getting back the hostages that they were fighting for. And with that off the table, and with Hamas having 1,700, did you say, 1,700 Palestinian detainees, as they're called, returned home, it does take away some of the, you know, at least premises for the violence. But, you know, all you have to do is see those aerial shots over Gaza, and it's just rubble. There's no sewer system. There's no water system. There's no hospitals. There's no streets. You can't even drive on the streets. People are going back to their homes and saying, I can't even find what street it was on. It is so destroyed. I mean, there is just so much to do, and it's going to take so much effort. And that wasn't any part of the discussion yesterday. And that has to be front and center.
But go ahead, Jamie.
Well, yes, and on the hostages, I agree, you know, that the hostages were such leverage for Hamas. You know, now they really don't have leverage. I guess that there are dead bodies that they may have or that may be buried under the rubble, but the fact that they don't have the leverage of having the hostages, and Israel doesn't have the justification of Hamas having the hostages, it brings us into a dramatically new phase of this conflict, which has lasted for, 1,000 years. Joe mentioned earlier, you know, Hamas demilitarizing or giving up their arms, you know, that's never going to happen. That's like asking Cookie Monster to give up his cookies. You know, they're going to have weaponry, and that's how they identify themselves. They're a terrorist organization. So, yes, yesterday was a great day, great pictures. It was great to see people get home to their families. And I, for one, I never thought it would happen. I thought they're never going to give up the hostages, because the day that they give up all the hostages, the people that were negotiating for Hamas are going to get obliterated by Israel. I'm surprised Israel has not yet, you know, taken out the hostage negotiators. But It will be interesting to watch in the coming days, for sure.
Yeah, when I visited Israel with a group of mayors in 2019, we spoke with a person who had been involved in peace negotiations, several attempts at peace negotiations over the years, a two-state solution, all of the various iterations. And one of the things that he said was something to the effect of, there's no definition of justice for one side that is not seen as an injustice by the other. This is a really very, very complex, I don't want to use the word intractable, because it presumes that we can't push through it, but these attempts at finding a way towards peace have been attempted. And again, it's where I think the president just really underrates how complex the situation is. And we all have to hold out hope that maybe something shifted in the horror of what we've seen over the last 2 years on both sides that will allow those who truly want peace to be given a voice and to prevail. And that is a hope that we always have to have, I think.
We have several letters. I want to get to a few of them before we take a break here in 5 minutes or so. D writes, just call it a genocide. That's what it is. It has been certified by such by the UN. Even Israeli institutions have labeled it a genocide. Show that much moral courage. Then we go to Regina. Israel continues to expand into the West Bank with tacit and explicit encouragement from U.S. officials. How will peace come if there is still colonial expansion, land theft, and mob killings as settlers steal farmland from Palestinians in the West Bank, assuming full compliance and the best possible forward momentum for Gaza in digging out? That was something that our panelist Jim Ketterer was talking about yesterday on the program. Guy writes to us and says, while the intention may not have been to absolve Hamas of any responsibility, your panelist's description of the conflict in the Middle East as Netanyahu's war hits the ear wrong, the same as if one heard someone talk about Poland's war in 1939. At the very least, we should include the name of the instigating party when describing a conflict.
Yeah, and I was referring to Netanyahu's conduct of the war. There were times, as we know, throughout this entire period where there were opportunities for a ceasefire, and there were decisions that Netanyahu and conservatives in the government made prevented that. Those ceasefires from being successful. And so these were, I'm talking about his very conscious tactical decisions that were made by Netanyahu. I think the horrific, horrific terrorist attack on innocent civilians in Israel did demand a response. Any nation would have responded. But I am talking about as the war continued, the decisions that were made by Netanyahu to not select certain opportunities that many had hoped would lead to a ceasefire much earlier.
We go to Edie, who writes, this is good for Israel and Hamas. Now let's forge ahead. Let Trump stop the war in Ukraine and do it now. There's huge destruction and death there as well. Ongoing, longer than the Middle East. Thank you for being there, Edie. Then we go to DA, who says, on October 6, 2013, The Guardian described it as the deadliest year for Palestinians yet. It is intellectually dishonest in the extreme to describe October 7th as the beginning of anything. Do not repeat the falsehood that Israel's response was in any way justifiable or proportionate. Israel has been the aggressor since the beginning. This is a ceasefire because Israelis do not want the boycotts and international outcry. There has been no effort to end the genocide. Yes, the moment to breathe is a categorical good, but it is not a new anything. Then we check out, or we go to this letter from Liz, who says, hi, panel. For me, the solution is not complex. Israel must recognize the right of Palestinians to have their own lands, Gaza and the West Bank, and for Hamas to recognize the right of Israel to exist. The complexity is because the parties don't want to recognize either. And one more letter, and we will go to a break. Settlers are gobbling up the West Bank. This isn't over. Israelis want it all. That from Teresa. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. We'll come back to new topics. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
Cross your mind again, but it sends me into reverie. Black and white in my mind, I'm light on my feet.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And it's 9:47 on this Tuesday morning, the 14th of October. J.P. Miller, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Mike Spain all with us, and we'll move on to topics. We do have some more letters that I want to get to that came in during the break, but you want to also make a point as well about a a previous letter.
Yeah, I mean, that last letter that talked about Israelis wanting to expand into the West Bank, there are certainly people in Israel who want to expand into the West Bank and who don't support a Palestinian state. But there are millions of Israelis who do. And so just as in this country, I don't support what's happening in Washington. I don't support a government stripping away the right to free speech, stripping away health care from people who need it the most. But that doesn't mean that I don't believe that our country has a right to exist. And we've seen this huge uptick in anti-Semitism in our community and really, you know, across the country. And I think we have to be very mindful of when we say these things, how we're saying them. Because if people around the world thought that all of us sitting in this room supported the policy decisions that are being made in this country, I would think that that would stoke up a lot of anti-American hate and finger pointing. So I just think we have to be mindful about what we say and how we say it so that we are creating the space for us to have conversations that will lead to peace, not that will continue to be divisive and divide us.
We go to letters. Devin writes, what are your thoughts on how clean and healthy the released hostages looked? I expected them to be dirty, bedraggled, and wounded. I didn't really realize that.
There were photos. I did see a photo of a hostage that was taken months ago, and he looked emaciated, but yesterday he looked healthier. But, you know, they say that they are all have a certain level of starvation in their, and, you know, they're getting medical care and their diets are going to be modified until they get healthier. I mean, it's not like that you can just walk back into life physically. And, of course, there's just think about the psychological trauma that being held a hostage during this 2-year period must leave on somebody.
Chris writes, does the panel have a pro-Palestinian bias? Please consider the massive use of disinformation by Hamas and its supporters. For example, they say IDF killed babies. IDF did not kill babies. It has never been proven. Hamas, on the other hand, reveres martyrdom, and Palestinian mothers brag about their children being martyrs. Please check my facts if you need to. That from Chris. Then we go to Regina, the government is separately from the people all over, but West Bank expansion has been policy and happened even when it was nominally not policy for all Israel's existence. I mean, it started with not Israel, but UK colonialism. This is the artifact of colonial hubris and blunder. Jay, while I'm glad the hostages are home, Trump has not a caring bone in his body for the Palestinian people. The sooner the fighting is done, the sooner he can put forth plans for Trump World Gaza with casinos and all. That from Jay. And there was one other here that I wanted to get to. Will I find it? Maybe not.
That is really a hideous thought. the last letter there of a Gaza like Atlantic City. I mean, I don't believe that's going to happen. But even to talk about it is repugnant.
We go to. I had a letter that I flagged and then somehow I unflagged it, so now I don't know where it is.
Must have been a good one.
Yeah, well, it was a good one, but because it sort of brought a lot of different issues together, meaning that we look at the peace deal, but what is going on at home and the peace that we are not seeing in our cities is something that really needs to be addressed as well. And I think that's a good point. Maybe I'll find it eventually. It's I'll get there. Let's move on to other topics. Move on, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we welcome you as always. So let's see. We have just about 7 minutes. Let me find a story that will probably fit that time pretty good. So Kristi Noem has a video that is being sent to airports. And Basically, it is a video that you put up at the TSA checkpoints, and it talks about in the past, the video talks about real ID and making sure that you fly safely and have all of the credentialing and so forth that you need to get on an airplane. Well, now airports in more than a half dozen U.S. markets have declined to display a video in which Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem blames congressional Democrats for the government shutdown and any related travel delays, citing the political nature of its content, according to local authorities. Officials that oversee airports serving Buffalo, Charlotte, Cleveland, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Seattle, and Portland said the video could violate internal policies that bar political messaging or contravene state or federal laws that prohibit the use of public resources for political activity. We believe the Hatch Act clearly prohibits use of public assets for political purposes and messaging. That, according to Molly Prescott, a spokesperson for the Port of Portland, which operates Portland International Airport, enacted in 1939, the Hatch Act bars federal employees from engaging in politics while on the job and is meant to ensure that federal programs are administered in a nonpartisan fashion.
So I believe that the video, I've been told anecdotally that the video is playing at the Albany County Airport. I believe that the county executive is traveling, so I'm hopeful that when he sees it, he will immediately call the board and tell them to stop airing it. I do have a request for a call into the majority leader, who also sits on the airport board, I believe, Joanne Cunningham, to get an understanding of what their position is on this. But I have received calls and emails from people demanding that I remove the video.
Yes, but I do not
run the Albany County Airport, but I share the sentiment. I've seen the video. There is absolutely no public safety value to the video. There is no information being conveyed that allows people to feel safer or be safer. It is just clearly political, and I don't think it has any place in our airport or in any other airport.
Yeah, Albany does have the you know, as you're going through security, it does have a big screen, and Kristi Noem has been on it in the past talking about real ID and things like that. So it probably is airing.
Really fast. Like, when she took office, it was like 3 days later that thing was in the airport. I was surprised of that. And I think you could make a case that even those messages were somewhat political, but certainly not as overt.
Well, they were promoting. They were self-promoting.
Yes,
question.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which, Noem, a politician self-promoting. No, really.
Noem says in the video, it is TSA's top priority to make sure that you have the most pleasant and efficient airport experience as possible. However, Democrats in Congress refuse to fund the federal government, and because of this, many of our operations are impacted. We will continue to do all that we can to avoid delays that will impact your travel, and our hope is that Democrats will soon recognize the importance of opening the federal government.
It's a political ad. It's incomprehensible to me that this is airing in any airport anywhere in the United States.
When you say political ad, though, I would say it's also a befuddled, silly political ad. It's not like it's an effective tactic. Would you agree? I mean, when I'm in line at the airport, yep. I don't listen to what she's saying.
It feeds the base that just love dumping on Democrats, and they eat it up. But again, when you travel, I do want to have a calm, relaxing experience. And that's not how I want to start it.
Kristi Noem does not invoke calm.
No, you shouldn't be that frustrated by the time you're not even through TSA. You haven't even gotten to the Chick-fil-A yet, for God's sake.
And some people are actually carrying their small dogs.
Is that something that bothers you?
Well, not me, but Kristi Noem might not like it.
I was in a deep cut.
That's nice.
I was in the Albany Airport last week, and I did not notice it. I can't imagine any message.
Look up from your phone, JP.
Well, no, I like the peaceful experience of being in there. There's really not a lot to do except for figure out, you know, is it going to be lunch or breakfast at Chick-fil-A?
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. And yes. And in this particular day, even with TSA pre-check, do I need to take off my shoes? Do I not need to take off my shoes? Do I need to put my belt on? Do I not need to? And once you do that, you're done. Mm. I agree with you. But I will say that I watched that video, and I wanted – I not only did
in
I
In the
watch
airport
it,
you saw it?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I went like twice. I like
The old
I couldn't,
one.
No, the old and the new one. Oh. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it.
Do you have pre-check or no?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. But still, but you're there and you're waiting, and it's yeah. and it's on a large monitor, and yep. it's just – it's. You know,
I wonder if there's like
it's
a pre-check status.
Yeah,
you
no,
could
I was yeah, yeah. I was surprised.
Else.
I was really
wow.
surprised when I saw it. You know, the original one, and I just thought, really, I don't ever remember any other Homeland Security administrator doing this. This is like a very self-promoting.
Do you think it's a choice of the board of the Albany Airport or the Albany County exec? Who do you think makes that decision, Mayor?
That I don't know. I would assume it's the board. I mean, it is
well,
a board, but he appoints the majority of the board members, so presumably his view on it would be compelling. One
and I'm
think.
Not making excuses for anybody, but when you get a message in that said this is the new message that we're playing at the TSA, you're like, oh, okay, and then later you realize exactly what you're showing. But we'll see. We'll take a break. We'll talk about more stuff. It'll probably make you upset, too. We'll talk to you in just a few moments. We're going to go over to news, and we'll be back right after this.
You would never be with me. I tried it to be mean to me so you would like it. To be outed, so I out myself.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, the 14th of October. It's 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Do you know where your radio show is? Well, we're right here. And you can always join us, panel at wamc.org. We welcome the Empire Report's J.P. Miller, Mayor of the City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. We move on to other topics. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to this story, which I want to hear from everyone, but I'm going to start off with Mike because, you know, our journalist in residence here. I want to hear what he has to say about this. Several news organizations, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, Newsmax, and NPR. Newsmax and NPR being on the same page. Isn't that interesting?
In the same sentence.
Yes. Wow. I have announced that their journalists will not sign a new set of Pentagon restrictions affecting news gathering in the massive military complex. Quote, we fundamentally oppose the restrictions that the Trump administration is imposing on journalists who are reporting on matters of defense and national security. That, according to Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, who said in a statement on Monday announcing that the outlet's staff would not sign the Pentagon document, the requirements violate our First Amendment rights and the rights of Americans who seek how taxpayer-funded military resources and personnel are being deployed. The 21-page Pentagon document lays out a number of requirements at odds with freedom of press protections, according to lawyers representing the news organizations. One is a provision stating that journalists could be deemed a security risk, quote-unquote, based on several considerations, including whether they disclose classified or even unclassified information without the Pentagon's authorization. Media lawyers worry that the stricture could expose reporters to punishment for engaging in routine reporting. The document replaces a simpler one-page form that outlined access limitations for journalists, according to the Pentagon Press Association. Implementation of the new policy is on a fast track. Journalists have until Tuesday at 5, so 5 o'clock this afternoon,
Eastern time,
to decide whether or not to sign the form. Those who do not must turn in their credentials one day later. Other news outlets, including The Guardian and CNN, have also said they would reject the policy. The announcements reflect the news media's wide-ranging frustration with efforts by Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, to curtail the physical movement of reporters in the building and impose fresh limits on their activities.
Well, they already have done a lot of that. The several establishment, whatever that means, maybe legacy news organizations have lost their positions and lost their space in the Pentagon press room, and some newer, lesser known and lesser, newer and not so proven bloggers, et cetera, have gotten space in there. And this has happened in the White House press corps, and I suppose it's true anywhere. If a government agency, not even a $1 trillion a year government agency, decides that they want to restrict access, they can just stop talking to the media or stop talking to certain reporters. I can remember as an editor at the Times Union, I was city editor, and one of my reporters was aggressively reporting about a company that was building a mall near here, and it was very controversial. And she exposed a lot of, facts about what happened in other cities where they made promises and never came, and then did not fulfill promises to, fix roads, whatever. And they decided they were never going to talk to her. They wouldn't take her call. So she'd do the reporting, she'd talk to everybody, and then someone else would call up and get a comment from the developer. And, that kind of thing is going to happen. People will get end runs. There'll be people so offended by this in the Pentagon that they will become sources for the reporters. It'll be interesting to see if Fox News signs on. They hadn't said either way whether they would. ONA, One News America, I think, did sign it. They're very close to Trump. They're trying to elevate their profile. But I am heartened that so many news organizations have come forward and put their foot down and said, we're not going to sign it. I think it's encouraging, and I think they'll still be able to do the reporting, just like the developer wasn't able to stop the Times Union from doing aggressive reporting. And we'll learn most of it, but it'll be more difficult.
Mike, can I ask Mike, can I ask a question? If they don't get their press credentials, can they not participate in press briefings from this defense secretary?
Often they can't get in the room. Yeah. I mean, but right now, even in being in the room, they don't get recognized. If Hegseth doesn't want to answer their question because he doesn't like their news organization, doesn't like them. I mean, the same thing happens in the White House press corps. The White House spokesperson doesn't call on certain media when they know that they're aggressive. They move them to the back. They put other people up front. They don't honor protocols that there's a Pentagon Press Association, there's a White House Correspondents Association, and they've always had cordial but tense relationships with every administration over rules and protocols. But Trump has led the way of kind of flushing those down the toilet and doing things the way he likes to do.
Have you seen this 21-page document? I tried to search for it and couldn't find it.
I haven't seen it. I've just seen the highlights, the various
because to me,
restrictions.
It sounded, I would go a step further. I read, one of the paragraphs, a censorship. In other words, you can't print anything, either classified or non-classified,
exactly,
without clearing it with us. I mean, that's just censorship. That would be like me saying, okay, the Times Union, you can't print a story about the city of Albany
and wouldn't that
until
be funny?
I've read it and told you whether you can print this or not.
And wouldn't that be funny? I mean, it would never. It could never happen.
First of all, I'm a little too busy to actually get bogged down in those details. But it seems like this is out and out censorship. It's
It is absolutely an attempt to censor. I mean, you know, there's times when news organizations will write complex stories about technology or some complicated deal, and we'll hand them to people in the organization and say, look at this, see if I got anything wrong, and then talk about it. I mean, that's good journalism. That's fact-checking. Right. It's making sure that you didn't get something wrong. But to have stories reviewed before they're published, that's like during war. That's like World War II, when news organizations were constricted legitimately, when we wouldn't write about, well, they wouldn't, not me, but they wouldn't write about troop movements and various other tactical things that could possibly harm the U.S. war effort.
I do think it's interesting. We've had panelists on the show in the past who have said on other issues, have said, look, I don't understand why those reporters of I think we're talking about coverage of the State of the Union address or even the daily White House briefings, that not much comes out of them. It's very programmed. And you would be better off as a reporter to go out and just work your sources and work the phones and find out the information than you would be working there. I think there's a point to that. However, also to this, that you have to like pass it all by Pete Hegseth's office before it goes out is just kind of crazy.
The other side of this, too, is that Hegseth has warned people in the Pentagon that they will be checked and subjected to lie detector tests to make sure they're not being sources for journalists. They'll probably have their phones tapped. I mean, they risk serious consequences if they talk to a reporter, feed a story to a reporter, give a reporter background and context. And that is the way that it works. A lot of times there's people in government who explain the background. They're nerdy, they're micromanagers, and they tell you things that go on and how it works. But you don't really, and it helps you understand it. And that is the back and forth that happens on every level. And to just walk in and come up with a 21-page document and try to seize that is not only is it offensive to anybody who believes in the First Amendment, I think it's naive and just ridiculous.
It is totally naive and ridiculous. And Joe, you're right in that the press briefings are 99% of the time boring, and you're not going to get a lot of information out of them, and they're just giving out what their message of the day is, except for when it really matters, when there is a war. I remember, after September 11th, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Dick Myers. Remember those press conferences were kind of must watch. And when
during
something
COVID, right?
During COVID, those press conferences become at certain specific times in our history become must watch. And having our leaders be accountable and having questions asked of them, very difficult questions that they many times don't know the answer to. That is when those press briefings really become must watch and super essential and super important for journalists to be able to ask questions that Americans want the answers to.
Yeah, there's a place for those, and there's a place for the the harder work of being on the ground and just working your sources and learning about the subject that you're reporting about.
But let's look at what they're trying to do. I mean,
Muzzle the news, control the news.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly.
From one department, but if you do it one department, it's going to start to go from department to department.
It's kind of
department.
Informally already happened all across the administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what's happened in the White House press corps.
Right.
A lot of legitimate, a lot of legacy, a lot of, I think, very legitimate news organizations. Look at the Associated Press, how they've been banished because they won't recognize the international, the president's name for the Gulf of Mexico, and they used the international name of it, instead of the Gulf of Americas. And the retribution against them for that, I mean, I think silly disagreement.
It is silly, and yet
it has ramifications.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think the other piece of this is this move by Hegseth to rebrand the Department of Defense, the Department of War.
Yes.
We should never want war. And I haven't spoken to a veteran ever who have said, you know, war should really be our goal. It's not that bad. And so we just celebrated at the Slater the 250th anniversary of the Navy. And one of the things that I talked about and other people talked about was the impact of our naval fleet in maintaining peace, in preventing war. And so thinking about that shift, I think it is a signal of far worse things to come. It's a shifting of the entire culture of the Pentagon and why we have had a Department of Defense for as long as we have had, because it should never be our goal to go to war. We should never be at war with our cities. The language that is being used, you know, using our American cities as training ground for our combat units. Think about that. Think about that. And that does not make us a better country. It doesn't make us a stronger nation. It doesn't make us safer. And so I think having access inside that building does have some importance, because as this continues, I think it is going to be harder and harder to get information. And so I think it's, you know, it puts the media in a really difficult position, you know. But when he said access to the Pentagon is a privilege, not a right, well, sorry, Pete, but it's our money.
Yeah, and it's coming at a time, of course, when news media is very stressed, and the economics have shifted dramatically in the last 15, 20 years, so that there's not as many reporters out there. There's not as many organizations that can fund having a dedicated military reporter. So they're really leveraging at a time. Hegseth is leveraging this at a time when there's a weakness in the ability of many news media to fight it.
You also have to imagine, Mike, do you think that they expected people to sign it or no?
I would bet that they expected more people to sign it. I'll bet they're surprised that, I mean, the CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, they probably figured they wouldn't sign it. But I bet they're surprised Fox hasn't. Right.
Fox and Newsmax. I mean, if they can't get them, that's you know, that's it.
Well, and then they cave, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Yeah. I mean, it'll become a source kind of reporting, and then they'll lose control over any narrative that they want and any message they want to get out. The message will become different, you know, than they want.
At the risk of prolonging this discussion, but my understanding was that. There was a point where they had an agreement, right? They had an agreement.
The Pentagon Press Association had negotiated some things to mitigate this,
and then once they put it in writing and added it 13 pages, that's when all hell broke loose.
But Mike, if you're the defense secretary, don't you want CNN's camera there and CNBC, you know, don't you want the cameras there to get your message out onto the airwaves?
That assumes that you you want to get a message out, and they want to control a message. You're right. I can't disagree with you, but this administration has been hostile. I mean, to call it hostile is putting it mildly.
Combative,
it has been combative to the press and to the organizations that raise questions. Just by asking a question, you become a pariah in these press rooms at these various agencies.
Let's we're going to move on to another story. I wanted to see if we have any mail here. Our producer is off today, so I'm doing the mail myself, and I'm doing a really bad job of it.
We have a lot of good letters, Joe.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Let's see. I don't know how I'm doing here. Good morning. I was at the Albany Airport 2 days ago, Sunday at about midnight, to pick up my wife from the airport. The Repulsive Gnome video was on a constant loop. I had to listen to it maybe 50 times in the short amount of time that I was there. The pickup area for arriving passengers, as you probably know, is adjacent to the TSA security area. Just a totally bizarre, brainwashing, Big Brother and un-American experience. Shame on the airport for subjecting us to this. That from Stephen. The right doesn't want their tax dollars to fund schools that promote the left's propaganda. I don't want mine spent on the airport website propaganda from the right. All right. I find it interesting that CBS and Barry Weiss, at least so far, are not among those refusing fealty and submission to Pentagon permission.
Are not among those refusing. They haven't signed it.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, today at 5 o'clock, they will be among those if they have not signed it. So, you know, we'll see.
We go to David, who says, you wouldn't want to have reporters reveal troop movements that the Pentagon might be doing. That's Hegseth's job, you know, on a Signal app.
Right. Well put. With a reporter on that conversation.
There,
yes.
There is that. Someone should use retort to Trump. Someone should use his words about putting old issues aside, quote about his comments regarding the Middle East, right back to him in regards to our divisions. That from Sally. William wants in on the discussion regarding the TSA airport message. I was at the TSA waiting area at the Albany International Airport with two other people, thinking I was hearing a newscast about TSA, Democrats, and Congress. I was shocked when I walked over and saw it in full, running on a loop, attacking Democrats. She specifically mentioned Elise Stefanik praising her, leading me to believe it's been modified in all airports to mention local Republican representatives. I had not heard that.
I hadn't either. That'd be very interesting.
I did receive a text from someone who says that they did contact McCoy's office and they were told that he has no authority to take the video down. So.
So it's up to the airport board.
There
likely?
Will be more to come. But yeah. People should, you know, look, the names of the people who are on the airport board are available on the Albany County Airport website. And this is what democracy looks like. If you're ticked off about it, call them, send them an email and let them know that this is not what we want for our Albany County Airport.
Aside from the website, they also have framed headshots of themselves in the airport, which I always that's a cool thing.
Cool.
That's cool.
You know what?
Wouldn't you want your headshot?
When I go to airports and it's a mayor that I know, because a lot of times the airports are owned by the city. Mm-hmm. So like Jane Castor, when she welcomes me to Tampa, I always text her. I'm like, thanks so much for welcoming me. That really
means
a lot.
They're recording on the train when you're driving.
Yeah. Those are great.
But that's got to be kind of
we
fun.
We welcome you to the Atlanta Metro area.
You know,
This the end of William's statement is, I was so shocked I immediately called Matt Hunter, airport director of communications, and left a message to express my displeasure. This is what the mayor was just talking about, and asked that it be taken down like it was at Buffalo and Westchester airports as it violates the Hatch Act. So interesting to see what's
I think
what
the Hatch Act, which was passed, in 1938 to prevent this kind of thing, has fallen through the cracks. Enforcement of it. It seems like it's an idea that just has gone away.
Well, but I will tell you. So, we had a rally in support of Tish James on Sunday, and Congressman Tonko couldn't be there. And so he had asked me to read a statement from him. Well, one of his people who works in his office was also at this rally. He happens to be the head of the Young Democrats, and he was there to speak on behalf of the Young Dems. And I said, well, do you want to read Paul Tonko's statement? Well, of course he couldn't, right? He said, well, no,
as
I'm here. I'm here in my private capacity, right? As the head of the Young Dems to speak out at a political rally. I'm not here in my staff capacity as a staff member to a member of Congress.
That's commendable.
That's commendable. So I think it hasn't fallen through the cracks for people who have integrity.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back. We'll continue. We'll wrap up the show on the other side of news from the BBC. We still welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org.
I can tell he feels alive, and he's been wanting it. So I'll make his heart beat if it kills me. Take this gospel on the road. I'll sell a smile and say I bought it with my soul.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our last segment together with this terrific panel, J.P. Miller, Kathy Sheehan, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters. Last call for those, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we used to talk about a thing called power of the purse. Remember that? And the Congress was the entity that had the power of the purse. In other words, they had the power to spend the Americans' money. This is something that the mayor mentioned, you know, my money, and that's how they spend it. And okay, so now, the question is, this is an article that I'm referencing from the Washington Post, which is Congress is losing its grip on the power to spend Americans' money. Fred Upton, a former Michigan congressman, says Congress doesn't really have a say on anything. No one's putting their hand up to say, stop. There are really three political parties in Washington, according to an old saying, Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. The latter are members of Congress lucky enough to get placed on the powerful committees that dole out roughly $1.6 trillion, with a T, in federal funds for the military and government services each year. They have traditionally shared a common goal of jealousy, guarding their tremendous ability to steer federal resources. It's a bond that often defies the political rules of gravity that govern everything else on Capitol Hill. But now those ties are being tested like never before. The White House was aggressively encroaching on Congress's power of the purse even before it began using the ongoing government shutdown as justification for rolling back billions more in spending. Democratic and many Republican appropriators are angry at Trump's White House for unilaterally canceling contracts, abruptly freezing billions of dollars in congressionally sanctioned funding, and trying out a pocket rescission technique to permanently withhold $5 billion in foreign aid without congressional input. Republicans who control both chambers of Congress have largely swallowed those concerns out of fealty to President Donald Trump. In the process, they have allowed their power to erode. Mayor.
Well, certainly, when I talk about what's happening in Washington, I talk about the Republicans. This is not just Donald Trump. This is a Republican Party that is ceding its power. And so I'll give you a small example at the local level. I was asked by a member of the council who I was creating a new position, and he came to me and he wanted me, in exchange for his support of creating this new position, he wanted me to agree that two director level individuals had to be confirmed by our council. So under the Jennings administration, there was a change made to our charter that required that commissioners and chiefs have to be confirmed by the council. And I said to him, I may be perfectly fine, Kathy Sheehan, citizen of Albany, saying, sure, you can have confirmatory power over these two director positions, but I'm the mayor and I can't cede power that's given to me in the charter to you without the voters amending that charter and giving you that power. And that was an easy decision for me to make. I mean, even though in principle I may have thought, sure, the council can confirm these two positions, that is not what's happening in Washington now. What is happening in Washington is that power that has been given to Congress in this balance of power that we all learn about starting in elementary school is being given away. And how you get that back, I think, is very problematic. It's very troubling. People should be deeply, deeply, deeply troubled by this.
Yeah, as we learned on Schoolhouse Rock, the powers, the Congress is the one that controls the money. Well, it controls it as long as it controls it. And if it doesn't step in to maintain that control and shows fealty to the White House that apparently now controls it. You know, we learned all this during DOGE back earlier in the year, where Congress could have stepped in. Some Republicans objected here and there, but pretty much they laid down and let it roll right over all of us. They have given up that power. And Bo Breslin, who's the constitutional expert, one time when he was on the roundtable, said that Justice Felix Frankfurter back in the 40s said when Congress doesn't exert its constitutional right and the executive takes it over, that basically is tacit approval of what the executive branch is doing. And that's what Congress has done this time. They have, you know, essentially by being silent, have legitimized Trump's control of the purse strings and handed that power without any constitutional amendment. Handed that power over to the White House, and now you're seeing what he's doing with it.
You used to see, Mike, presidents veto bills from Congress. When was the last time you think we've seen a presidential veto of a bill in Congress?
Well, there hasn't been any bills passed that Trump didn't want because he has total control of both House and Senate.
Right. But, you know, I don't remember Biden. Did he veto any? Did Obama veto?
Wasn't the effort to overthrow okay, the Obamacare vote in 2018, it didn't pass by one vote. Yeah, that wasn't a veto.
Congress is certainly with less competitive districts and gerrymandering on both sides, Republican and Democratic. There are Congress has proven itself over the last 5 or 8 or 10 years to be an unworkable legislative body. You can see it right now. The government shut down. We had government shutdowns. It seems like every year, every other year, every 3 years, we have debt ceiling fights. It's true that the president is limited in how much they can. You know, it's Congress's job to spend the money.
Appropriate the money. They're leaving it up to the president whether to let the money they've appropriated be appropriated.
Right. But there are real consequences in communities across the country. And I think that that's the other piece of this, that we need to connect the dots for folks to say, well, the reason that this project has been canceled or the reason that this health clinic is not being built or fill in whatever that project was, right? You know, the reason that, you know, your senator came and touted that this great investment was coming and now it's not, and it's because he's not doing his job or she's not doing their job and allowing the president to claw this money back. And so that's the accountability piece. People need to see that connection in their communities. We had a $20 million grant that came to a group of not-for-profit entities in the city of Albany to do really incredibly great work, and that was part of this rescission, and it's been clawed back. So these things are not going to happen. Yet Congress wanted them to happen. Right. It was their vote. And so, you know, that and the precedent that gets set. Right. Well, I don't like this program. So Congress appropriated $100 million to the EPA to do XYZ. And now I don't want them to do XYZ. You know, at some point in time, the shoe will be on the other foot.
But this was solved during the Nixon administration when he was impounding funds. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said he couldn't do it. But in order for that fight to happen, Congress had to object and take him to the Supreme Court. They're not fighting. They're just lying down and letting it happen.
So this doesn't end anytime soon, right? I mean, obviously until there's a...
Well, look, we're fighting over what estimates are $40 billion, right? The total cost of Obamacare is estimated at about $110 billion annually, and the Biden subsidy is about $40 billion of that. I mean, when you put that in comparison to the extension of the tax cuts, which are estimated to cost between $400 and $450 billion annually, 10 times that number. That's what the Republicans are refusing to budge on, a number that's 10% of what they've given to wealthy businesses and the richest people in this country. And the impact on families is going to be significant. People are going to lose their health care. They're not going to be able to afford their health care. They're going to have to choose between being able to make a car payment or pay for their health care. Over $40 billion. And that's why the Democrats are fighting this fight. And it is resonating. People are seeing what their new bills are going to be without this subsidy in red districts as well as blue districts. And it is sending a message that the Republicans in Washington do not care about average working families because they would rather shut the government down than figure out how to appropriate $40 billion and make these Biden subsidies a permanent health care plan that helps low and middle income working families across this country.
All right, we have about 4 minutes. I think we can shoehorn in one more topic.
Let's go.
Here. And you ready?
Lightning
ready?
Round.
I think we will have gotten to everything, which is a rarity for all of us, and I think this is good. So we'll end with Obamacare, and I think this is this really dovetails nice on what we were just talking about. But I thought this was a fascinating article. The Washington Post wrote about why Republicans' attempts to kill Obamacare keep backfiring. Here's the lead line on this article, and this you talk about a grabber. Republicans have tried more than 70 times over the past 15 years to weaken or kill Obamacare, but their campaign keeps backfiring. The sweeping tax and spending bill President Donald Trump signed this summer got his party closer to that goal than ever before. Though never marketed as a repeal, it unraveled much of the law and is expected to eventually push millions of people who gained insurance since the Affordable Care Act's passage off the rolls. Even that legislative achievement is proving politically fraught. So why does the campaign keep backfiring? We have 3 minutes. I will yield it to whoever wishes to speak out on this issue. JP, go ahead.
I don't understand why they fight against Obamacare. I think Obamacare, if it was passed in what year would it have been passed? 2009. So that was 15 years ago. I think it, if you ask the American people, I think it's a popular program. And I don't understand why they continue to try to dismantle it. Maybe it helps them with their base, but I think that in terms of moderates, I imagine that moderates and swing voters think that Obamacare has been a success and should stay in place.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think, you know, we talked about appealing to the grievances, you know, this aggrieved base that thinks that somehow somebody's getting something that they don't deserve, that they haven't earned. You know, it appeals to our most base instincts. I think it's a plan that works. It's a plan that we should be building on and improving, because if we can provide people with access to health care, people are healthier and it reduces overall health care costs. So the fact that this money is going to come out of the economy, because that's what will happen, $40 billion will come out of the economy that is currently funding health care. And so that's going to hurt particularly marginalized health care places, rural areas, inner city areas. So I think they've picked the wrong windmill to joust at, and they need to move on.
Well, I think it's a grievance that the President Trump has against Obama. He's wanted to get rid of that all along, and to blow it up by blowing out its foundation, meaning these subsidies that were passed by Biden and signed by Biden, is another way to do it. And it gets so personal. I mean, even yesterday when he was talking to the Knesset in Jerusalem, Trump started just to rant about how awful Obama was. And he just is fixated with that. So getting rid of Obamacare, despite the horrible impact. And statistically, it started to happen with Obamacare. As more people got health care, the actual rise in the cost of health care began to slow. It didn't reverse, but it began to slow, attributed to the fact that more people were getting some kind of health care before the illness became very serious. And that was the plan, and it was working. Now, figuring out where the $40 billion is coming from or coming up with some ways to shave some of that off, let's have that discussion because it's a lot of money. But make it more efficient, but do it with earnest. Don't try to just submarine torpedo the program, which is what they're doing yet again.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us. J.P. Miller, Kathy Sheehan, Mike Spain, you're all wonderful. We'll be back right after this.